They lost to Penn State 85-80. The forecast from the National Weather Service on this Wednesday, the 21st, should be cloudy until late afternoon, but then sunny, a high of 39. Right now, cloudy, 28 Racine, 29 Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday from 9 until 6, and Saturday 9 until 5. For more, visit jackandrea.com. Support for the Morning Show and WGTD also comes from UW Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from UW Parkside in partnership with the UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the last several weeks, we have heard from high school students across the country speaking out forcefully on the issue of gun control. And wherever you happen to fall on the spectrum of public opinion about this divisive issue, I think we all need to be impressed with the effectiveness and vigor of these young people speaking out on this important issue. On today's program, we're going to first hear some excerpts from some of the speeches that have been delivered by young people, including survivors of the shooting in Parkland, Florida. And then we're going to be hearing from Todd Gitlin, who was a very important and effective activist back in the 1960s, first in the anti-nuclear movement and then in the peace movement. The occasion of our conversation back in 2003 was the publication of his book called Letters to a Young Activist, in which he seeks to draw together some lessons that he learned from his work as an activist, lessons which he thinks would be valuable for the young activists of today. We'll get to that conversation in just a little bit. But first, let's hear from some of the young people speaking out on the issue of gun control. We will hear from Emma Gonzalez and Sam Zaif, both survivors of the shooting in Parkland, Florida. Emma Gonzalez delivering a speech, Sam Zaif speaking in the meeting that was held at the White House at the invitation of President Trump. And we'll hear from a couple of other young people as well speaking out on this issue.
The people in the government who were voted into power are lying to us. And us kids seem to be the only ones who notice and are prepared to call BS. Companies trying to make caricatures of the teenagers nowadays, saying that all we are is self-involved and trend-obsessed, and they hush us into submissions when our message doesn't reach the ears of the nation, we are prepared to call BS. Politicians who sit in their gilded House and Senate seats funded by the NRA telling us nothing could have ever been done to prevent this, we call BS. They say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS. They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS. They say guns are just tools like knives and are as dangerous as cars. We call BS. No, they say that no laws could have been able to prevent the hundreds of senseless tragedies that have occurred. We call BS. That us kids don't know what we're talking about, that we're too young to understand how the government works. We call BS. If you agree, register to vote. Contact your local congresspeople. Give them a piece of your mind.
My name is Sam Zaif. I'm a student from Marjory Stoneman Douglas in Parkland. I lost a best friend who's practically a brother. And I'm here to use my voice because I know he can't. And I know he's with me, cheering me on to be strong, but it's hard. I want to feel safe at school. You know, senior year, in junior year, there were big years for me when I turned my academics around, started connecting with teachers, and I started actually enjoying school. And now, I don't know how I'm ever gonna step foot on that place again. Or go to a public park after school, or be walking anywhere. Me and my friends, we get scared when a car drives by. Anywhere. I don't understand. I turned 18 the day after. Woke up to the news that my best friend was gone. And I don't understand why I could still go in a store and buy a weapon of war, an AR. I was reading today that a person 20 years old walked into a store and bought an AR-15 in 5 minutes with an expired ID. How is it that easy to buy this type of weapon? How do we not stop this after Columbine, after Sandy Hook? I'm sitting with a mother that lost her son. It's still happening. In Australia, there was a shooting at a school in 1999. You know, after that, they took a lot of ideas, they put legislation together, and they stopped it. Can anyone here guess how many shootings there have been in the schools since then in Australia? Zero. We need to do something, and that's why we're here. So let's be strong for the fallen who don't have a voice to speak anymore, and let's never let this happen again. Please, please.
My name is Matt Post. I'm a 12th grader, the student member of the board for Montgomery County. And I believe that as students, we need to make a few things clear. To start, we will not sit in classrooms with armed teachers. We refuse to learn in fear. We reject turning our schools into prisons. We will accept nothing less than comprehensive gun control. And if it's what it takes, we will shame our national policymakers into protecting us. Yes. Not just in schools, but in churches, movie theaters, on the streets, and in the communities of color, which are disproportionately devastated by the sickness of gun violence. So let's make one last thing clear. Their right to own an assault rifle does not outweigh our right to live.
Yes.
The adults have failed us. This is in our hands now. And if any elected official gets in our way, we will vote them out and replace them ourselves. Enough is enough. Enough is enough.
I want all of you to know that you're all on the right side of history for this. Now, personally, I'm glad to take part in a powerful nationwide movement like the one that we're participating in today. But we can all agree, in an ideal world, none of us would be here. In an ideal world, the 21st graders and kindergartners who died in Sandy Hook would be in middle school today. In an ideal world, the 58 concert goers who were gunned down in Las Vegas would have gone home and returned to be with their families. In an ideal world, the 32 students who died at Virginia Tech would be employed professionals, and the 17 victims from Stoneman Douglas would probably be eating lunch at school right now, and the only thing they'd be worrying about was a test for next period. But unfortunately, this isn't the case. Unfortunately, we live in a country where lawmakers are more concerned about their contributions from the NRA than they are about the lives of their own constituents.
These are voices of some of the young people who have spoken out for the cause of greater gun control here in America. And it's probably important to add at this point that this is by no means an issue in which all young people speak with a unanimous voice. There are certainly young people who feel very differently than these young activists about this issue that continues to challenge all of us as Americans. Now to my conversation with Todd Gitlin, a very busy activist back in the 1960s and the author of a book called Letters to a Young Activist, part of a wide series of books of letters to a young, whoever it might be, letters to a young poet or letters to a young politician or letters to a young teacher, in which someone draws upon their own life experience in the hopes of helping a young person who is exploring the very same adventure. I began by asking Todd Gitlin to explain how he received the invitation to write a book called Letters to a Young Activist.
Well, I knew about the series, and the editor-in-chief, John Donatich at Basic Books, put it to me that it would be useful to speak directly to young activists, and I didn't need a lot of convincing, because I was, for years, I have stored up and thought through and wrestled with dilemmas and problems and opportunities of activism in the sorts of conversations that you have in the middle of the night with somebody you know well, and when there's not a lot of time for fol-de-rol nonsense, when you really want to talk straight from the heart and the mind, and this has seemed to me an opportunity to write in it. In a straightforward voice, conversationally. It's not a book of scholarship. It's not a history. It's not a, you know, it's not, it's not a sermon. It's not an analysis. It is, you know, in a sense, high-minded advice, but also with an eye to, you know, listening to the person sitting across the table from you. So it attempts to be part of a conversation.
And presumably, on the surface, at least, a conversation between you and a young activist wanting to do something now in the present scene. That's how you have crafted the book,
yes.
Although it is fascinating for all the rest of us who might not be on the surface, you know, sort of the recipients of the letters. And each chapter of this book is written as though it were a letter from you to this unnamed reader.
For the young at heart, you might
yes.
say.
One of the things you talk about, I think, in the very first chapter, very first letter, is about the terms and how you very much prefer the term activist, but how people looking from the outside in tend to gravitate towards the term protester.
Yeah.
I wonder why you think the term activist is more accurate and more preferable, and at its heart, what you think the term activist really means.
Well, you know, in another age, we would say simply citizen. Somebody who believes in taking action, somebody who's not a voyeur. You know, the activist question, when the activist hears about something going on in the world, for good or ill, is not, what should I think about that? Although that might be one question you ask along the way, but deeply the question is, what do I do about that? The activist has an active orientation to the world. The activist thinks about the world as something that's being shaped, not a spectacle that's being produced, not a performance, not something other people do, but thinks of the world as being actively made. My qualm about the term protester is it implies simply negativity. It implies that, you know, there are people in power who do things, you don't like them, and you go out with a big royal no. I don't think the no is what makes history. I think the yes is what makes history. And it's a challenge, actually, which I put to activists, to surpass the mere no and to articulate an ideal, a vision, a sense of a better way of life, a more sustainable, a more manageable, more rational way of life. I think that the activist is closer to my heart than the protester.
Hmm. You know, it's funny. I just looking at this first chapter, and now the irony of something you say makes more sense now that I've read something later in the book, when you kind of talk about the difference between those on the left and those on the right, and how those on the left tend to be, as people, a little less organized. They tend to be, you know, free spirits who don't really like to sit through meetings, who maybe don't take direction particularly well,
yeah.
who value personal freedom. I want to talk about that actually at great length a little later. But in this discussion about terms, you say that in the early days of the movement, we, meaning you and your colleagues, preferred the term organizer.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's kind of some irony in there, in that you, by nature, you tended not to be particularly organized people in the way we think
of
it.
Well, that's a good point. You know, actually, I never heard the term activist in the 60s. I didn't hear it till the 70s. We like the idea of an organizer. An organizer is somebody who takes seriously the people who are out there, who thinks that their ideas need discipline, need organization, need clarity, and you know, like an educator. The root of the word educate means to educe. It means to draw out. So an organizer is somebody who starts with people as they are and draws out of them their deepest impulses and tries to focus them tactically and strategically on getting from here to there. Organizers, I think, you know, maybe in this age, an organizer is a hopelessly retro notion, which is one reason why I went with the title Letters to a Young Activist rather than Young Organizer. Hmm. I think today, you know, people are mystified by this concept.
Right. We could also use, of course, other terms like agitators. But you go on to say a little later in this first chapter, without the disruptors, campaigners, and ideological pests, all noble words amount to nothing but blackboard dust. Mm. I love the way you put that. The idea that this turns into action and tries to make happen those ideas we have about a better world and how people need to be living.
Well, if you take a longer view, you realize that much of what conservatives claim they want to conserve was actually the product of agitators, campaigners, and disruptors, activists, in a word. You know, slavery didn't abolish itself. The eight-hour day was not produced by the benign judgment of the owners of steel mills and oil companies and railroads. You know, women didn't get the vote because men decided to give them a nice day. Gays didn't acquire the rights they have by the beneficence of the majority. Civil rights, the right to vote, was not achieved out of the goodwill of the white rulers, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, if you step back and you think about American value, what we call today American values were fought over and were fought for with tremendous vigor and sacrifice, and it is ever thus. I mean, the history belongs, you know, to those who get their hands on it and move it in the directions that make sense to large numbers of other people. And that's a very difficult business, which much of this book is about. And there are lots of dilemmas that you run into as you do it. But none of this is automatic. I mean, and you know, the sort of the notion that America is this sort of fixed, final, you know, object that, you know, that our job is just to, you know, to polish once in a while, I think is the wrong idea about a democratic society.
Well, and speaking of history, you tell us that history itself is kind of a complicated thing in the way that it unfolds. You say history does not proceed in a straight line, but rather in zigzags, reversals, arabesques, curlicues, even pleasant surprises. Mm. And you go on to say that no defeat is definitive. You rethink, the world changes, and you rethink again. You're never finished. That speaks back to what you said about the mistake of thinking of the United States of America, for instance, as an entirely fixed entity which should not be altered in any way.
Well, there's an implication also, and I hear it as you read my words back. It's an interesting experience to hear somebody else read your words. The activist is also active on her or himself. You know, you're not finished either. You know, sometimes, you know, I've changed my mind about a number of things over the years, and to me that's a compliment. Some people will point a withering finger at you and, you know, declare that you no longer hold the views that you held when you were 22 or something. I mean, to me, you as the activist are also the product of the activity. And smart activists are people who rethink themselves and their views as they test them, as they experiment in the world. I mean, in a way, this is how we live our private lives. who is complete at age 15, 20, 25? I mean, I'm 60 now. I hope I'm not complete. One views oneself. I mean, one should view oneself as an unfinished creature, and it's the same in politics.
We're talking with Todd Gitlin, the author of Letters to a Young Activist, which is part of the really extraordinary book series called The Art of Mentoring. Todd Gitlin, again, speaking right into what you were just talking about, you speak about how, particularly in the early years of the movement, one of the things which gave it vitality and direction and energy, and that was really an essential thing that we don't always think about, is the whole notion of playfulness. That when you act politically, that you need to act playfully too. And you say at another point, playfulness has another meaning. It is openness to experience. And openness to experience is how we learn. Joyful self-education. I think when people look back at the 60s, playfulness is not the first thing they think of.
Well, it's again in the spirit of learning from experience. This is a scientific attitude. A scientist is not a know-it-all. A scientist is someone who probes deeper into reality on the basis of on the basis of received wisdom, and then you see what works. I think whether you're in engineering, in law, in medicine, the people who get results are the people who are open, who are observant. You know, the best doctors are the ones who are most observant. And I think the same thing is exactly true of the actor. The best writers, I mean, the writers I know who I admire are always learning. And they're taking chances. You know, Henry James spent a lot of his mid-career writing plays, which bombed. I don't think we think of him as a failure for it. I think we should admire the fact that he tried something different. And the same, I think, is true in the practical world of politics. We tend to scorn people who change their views. We call them wafflers or something like that. I mean, to me, a great politician, and we need great politicians, a great political leader in a movement, somebody like Martin Luther King, is somebody who's in process, somebody who is absorbing new data and rethinking. We admire that. I mean, when we feel the pain of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, it's not, I think, because Kennedy's achievements were so immense, but because he, as such a young man, he was still in the process of learning and planning and rethinking. And when we think of his great moments, I think, we think of moments when he discovered how important civil rights was, which he didn't know when he came into office. He discovered that you can't just organize the CIA to straighten out another country at will. Some people believe that he was learning from the failures in Vietnam, that this was a misguided mission, and so on. I think, the same thing with Franklin Roosevelt, a great politician. We few people know that he campaigned for president in 1932, in favor of a balanced budget. But when he came to office, he discovered that was a foolhardy goal, and he discarded it. And we applaud the doing things. By the way, it's also in business or in other fields. Who do we really admire the business leader who has a business plan and sticks to it, come what may? No, I mean, anybody who's blind to the world is blind to the world. These people walk off the edges of cliffs.
One of the things you point out about the movement that you were a part of in the 1960s was that, in a sense, it was historically isolated from what had come before because of the suppression of the left in the 1950s. And you say, actually, it was sort of a lucky thing to have that sense of historical isolation, that you didn't have a sense of stepping immediately in the wake of those who had come before you. And so you said you felt free to invent yourselves.
Yeah.
And that this sense of discontinuity was actually something that gave you a great deal of energy.
Yeah, it's true. It's ironic. We were marooned in history, and we felt the separation from the past, but we were also enabled thereby to think of ourselves as a new left. We didn't want to be a retread of the old communist left or anything like that. We thought it, you know, was that was the, those were bad ideas, the one party state dictatorship, all that sort of thing. We wanted to be open. We wanted to be experimental. We wanted to be passionate about issues which the old left hadn't had to consider or had decided not to consider. This made us also arrogant. We paid a certain price for our commitment to novelty. But I do think, you know, some of the giddiness and wildness, but also some of the genius of, I'm thinking in particular the civil rights movement and the spirit of nonviolence, some of, and the freshness of our language, I think, which didn't sound as though it had been unearthed from, you know, a tomb of left-wing piety. When we were fresh, we were very, very fresh, and this was actually a huge advantage. People like myself who were who had no illusions about the old left were attracted to the new left because it was, in fact, new.
Hmm. You also paint for us a more complete picture than we often see of the 60s and the fact that it, well, we know that it was a really polarized time, but even the, even within the new generation and amongst young people, there was intense polarization going on. And it was not that all young people in this country just sort of magically woke up one day feeling that we need peace, we shouldn't have war, but actually that there were sharp divisions and that in some ways the movement was a smaller player on the country's stage than we sometimes imagine.
Certainly for most of the decade that was true. It's very interesting. When I got to college, we were considered part of the silent generation. And insofar as there was political activity visible at American universities, the conservatives were more visible than liberals or radicals. There was a rally in Madison Square Garden in 1962, organized by the right-wing group, Young Americans for Freedom. We couldn't have done that. At that time, we had, you know, SDS, Students for Democratic Society, had a few hundred members, and, you know, and maybe a dozen reasonably substantial chapters, you know, rather small ones. But, you know, most people were disinclined to do political work. And I remember, you know, if you traveled around and visited SDS chapters or other groups, you would find them worried that this year's freshmen have lost interest and, you know, they're individualist, careerist, cynical, you know, or conservative. And, you know, it was always a struggle. So this notion that the 60s were easy because everybody was doing it, that it was just a fad.
Right. Well,
it's a serious distortion.
Sure. And you say it, that people like to talk about it as what was just an expression of the times.
Yeah.
And when, in fact, what you're, I think, saying is that for those that were active in the movement, it was a very conscious decision and sometimes a rather difficult choice they were making.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have to remember, I mean, I don't want to, you know, get out the violin here, but you know, we talk rather casually about the civil rights movement as if it were, you know, sort of a lark, you know, and it really is true. People died for ordinary American rights. It was, you know, Mississippi and Alabama were terror states. You were taking your life in your hands to go down there. I didn't. I'm not raving about myself here. You know, but people were seriously hurt just for, you know, for doing things that didn't even seem so important. You know, I was in a crowd who integrated or tried to integrate an amusement park outside Baltimore. I mean, it's north of the Mason-Dixon line, but we think of that as a northern place. You know, one of the people I was with was hit by a chunk of concrete, which was flung, hit her just above the eye, could have lost her eye. We were told that we were dangerous agitators by the, it was a completely nonviolent demonstration, I should ask. Our enemies were not nonviolent, but we were. We were denounced by the county executive, a man named Spiro Agnew, you may have heard of him, who was then at the beginning of his political career. We were denounced as American rights.
You give us kind of some interesting insights into the sit-in, and you talk about it being a tactic that is often misunderstood. You say, in fact, it was the sit-in was really kind of an act of genius. You call it an affirmation, an act of fertility, a creative act designed to engender a new situation.
Yeah.
Explain how a sit-in could do that.
It was that. You know, it was four college students from Greensboro, North Carolina, who came up with this notion. They had read some Gandhi. They didn't come out of nowhere. They were interested in nonviolent ideas. But what they were really doing through this form of direct action was saying, look, segregation is a moral evil, and you know, it's been in play for all these decades, and it's simply unbearable that it should continue. And so what we're going to do about it is we're going to abolish it for this moment. We're going to go and sit down at this lunch counter from which we were excluded. And so we're going to create a new situation by doing that. This is different from writing a letter to your mayor or your congressman saying, please change your policy. Although that's useful. There's time for that. But they were doing something else. They were producing a new situation in which the lunch counter was perforce integrated. And this caught fire. It was the form of an action. It was completely nonviolent. Of course, they were themselves beaten up and arrested. But it was transformative because it gave them the moral high ground. They were living American values, and the owners of the lunch counter or the police were in the position of enforcing something senseless. And most of the country, in fairly short order, was ready to see that it was senseless. And that was an act of genius. That was social invention.
You go on to say that the whole movement was, you call it, a school for spontaneity. And that sort of spontaneity and spirit of originality in finding other ways to do sit-ins and later teach-ins and other related things, that all of that was really essential. Originality counts. One size does not fit all, you say at one point.
Yeah. I mean, everything, when it gets imitated, becomes, you know, a formula, sort of a shtick. But at the beginning, people invent new things that capture imagination. You know, the women's move, the first feminist demonstration, going out to the Miss America contest and throwing all this gear in a garbage can, or the sit-ins, or the freedom rides, getting on the bus, and simply declaring that the segregation on the bus is idiotic and unconscionable, and we're going to abolish it. The playfulness, people had initiative, took initiative. They weren't waiting for headquarters to tell them what to do. They were acting as social experimenters. You know, the authorities often hadn't a clue as to what this was. J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI thought for many years, I mean, until 1968, they were convinced that the New Left was a sort of offshoot of the Communist Party, which was, the spirit was completely different. The Communist Party was indeed, you know, wholly centralized and top-down, and that's not the way the New Left was in the slightest. This was something really extremely different.
I liked how you said at one point, the spirit and stock of nonviolent tactics always needs replenishment. Like all forms of human action, nonviolence over time tends to degenerate into formula.
Yeah. Yeah, you have your formula, and the police have their formula, and everything is very stylized. And when people turn on the news and see the pictures, they say, oh, there that is again. And they think they already understand it. And it's a real challenge to activists to break through the formulas and to do something that's inventive and that it doesn't just look like a retread. That's always a challenge.
We are talking with Todd Gitlin, the author of Letters to a Young Activist. Todd Gitlin, you tell us about how the movement changed over the course of that decade and how anger tended to supplant that sense of joy and playfulness that was there early on. You say at one point, especially in the later 60s, I never felt more alive than when I was fired up. Fury was the source of transformative energy. That's beautifully put, and I'm sure very, very true as well, that anger played a role, I mean, an increasingly important role, but as you go on to say, also led to some destructiveness, and not just to things and shop windows and so on, but to some extent destructiveness to the good intentions of the movement.
Well, this is a trap. I mean, it's a human propensity to feel anger, and insofar as you feel helpless, you know your anger curdles into rage, and generally that doesn't lead activists down a fruitful path. It leads toward formula and toward a feeling that you are apart from the people that you must reach in order to win. We're seeing some of that today, and I was just having an email exchange yesterday with an activist involved in the recent anti-war activity who was observing, and this is something I've felt too, that, you know, it's very easy for people, to get worked up about George Bush, but antagonism toward George Bush is not the foundation of a healthy movement. It just won't. It just doesn't work that way. It's contrary to the spirit of winning people over and winning. I mean, in the end, you raised this question a while ago. You know, why is there such why is the right seem to have gone off with all the branches of government? And it's in part because because they're disciplined, but it's also and because they follow orders, but it's also because they have presented themselves as articulating the views, the sentiments of the American people, even when they don't. But they make the effort to talk that language, and I think it helps them.
Yes, by contrast, you talk about how the movement as it went on. Seemed more and more prone to build burn bridges, and which was in your view unfortunate. And you go on to say a little later what matters is results, and that sometimes got lost as activists became caught up in their own fervor. You say at one point, we felt too young to care about consequences. What catastrophic idiocy! How delicious it felt.
Yeah, yeah. This thrill of going for broke is, again, it's a human experience. It's not an extraterrestrial experience, but it is also reckless. People, I think, of strong convictions of all political persuasions are prone to this, and it can send you off the edge. Because precisely because you feel when you're in that mood that you don't need to trifle with the ordinary stuff and calculation of life. You simply having the feeling is enough, and stomping your foot and declaring the big no.
That reminds me too of something I thought was just fascinating when you talked sort of about the placard or the bumper sticker. And how that's one of the things we think about so much, but how slogans are by definition simplistic, and that a bumper sticker is not an argument, and that a more comprehensive view of the complexity of these issues and the world in which we live, that's not the kind of thing you paint on a sign. It's not the kind of thing that you chant in unison. But that's... There's a rub there that is not easy to come to terms with.
Well, in the recent anti-war period, the big demonstration in February in New York, my wife and I went down there with a sign that said, "Contain Saddam and Bush," and that was too complicated for some of the demonstrators. They didn't want to contain Saddam. They thought that was too complicated. You know, I think because they thought that, there was no chance that they were going to accumulate any more moral authority and support than they did. But this pressure to sort of turn yourself into a bumper sticker is something that, you know, we see in movements of all kinds. And it, again, it's, you know, it's a human pitfall that activists carry around with them because they lose patience, or they're impatient with the patience that they used to have, and they they think that if they you know, clench their fists and screw up their faces and reduce themselves to slogans, that this makes them more compelling. In fact, it makes them a sort of sect. It seals them off and makes them easily isolated, which is, of course, one thing that intelligent authorities encourage them to do.
Right. At one point you say, I confess I was once partial to the image of upheaval, having inherited a losing position in an unsatisfactory game, turn over the board.
Yeah.
What I learned is that when the old game collapses, the pieces do not discriminate. They fall on innocent heads, and the next game might be worse.
Well, this is also something, you know, you learn with difficulty. I learned with difficulty. You know, there's no script that is, you know, that inspires you with confidence to believe that this is all going toward glory. I mean, I suppose there was a time when people believed that history had a direction and that, you know, the script really had fallen from heaven. It was inscribed on tablets, and that was sort of, you know, there was the Marxist version of that. There's been a liberal version of it. Today, conservatives, I think, have that idea, that a sort of triumphalist idea of history. But I think this is an illusion. This is an excuse from thinking. And you had better take responsibility for your actions, and that means taking seriously the possibility that you may actually make things worse if you act stupidly, recklessly.
You really give us wonderful insights into what makes a movement possible. And, of course, part of what we're talking about is the collaboration between many individuals. You liken it at one point to a canvas. The canvas on which an activist works is society, a vast, messy, interdependent whole. In the artist studio, there's only room for one brush. But in a movement, your brush has to work in harmony with others.
And that's why it's an excruciatingly, at times, demanding discipline to be an activist, because you have to anticipate how other people are going to react to you. And your anticipation has to feed back into your choices. So you have to be a master observer and not just a creature of your willfulness. This is demanding, but also if you do it right, it's exhilarating because you see results.
I imagine that towards that end, then, is the direction of your advice that successful protest movements need insiders and outsiders. Explain those terms as you are using them, and why both insiders and outsiders are so important in the work of activists.
Well, activists almost always are hoping that policies of large institutions will change, and trying to make them change, whether it's government or corporations or what have you. And within these institutions, there are people who are more or less professional and more or less well-intentioned. Often they have their own frustrations with the institutions they're working in, and the fact that you're agitating on the outside, if you do it in a constructive way, can be used by them as leverage for changing policies. By the same token, if you're aware of what the reformers inside are doing, you can lend them some authority. I mean, whether we're talking here about people who work in the World Bank, or people who work in a university administration, or people who work in a corrupt trade union which needs reforming, or people who work in a you know, in a corporation that's making investment decisions. There are people who often, not always, but certainly often, there are people inside who want the world to be more sustainable, more decent, more just. And, you know, they're not your enemies. You can actually hook up with them. And you should, because you can each strengthen each other. That's what I mean.
I think of all that I read in your book, what I think maybe fascinated me the most, and I wish we had longer to talk about it, is when you compare the right and the left, both then and now, I think, and you talk about what you call the discipline gap.
Mm-hmm.
And you say the right wins the great game of organizations. They take instructions, they sit through meetings, I mean, they are willing to do what it takes to get the job done. And you talk about how the left is anti-authoritarian and pluralist to the point of separatism. We value differences and identity factions. We are fractious to the detriment of unity, but consider the price well worth paying. First of all, am I right that breakdown was as much in place in the 60s as it was, as it is now in 2003?
Yes, and I'm glad you fastened on that section, because I think it's extremely important. The discipline gap makes the left sort of playful and unpredictable, but it also weakens the left, because in the end you must acquire political power in order to accomplish your goal. The right is unambivalent about that. But the term power makes people on the left nervous. They don't want any of it, and they don't want anybody to have it. But of course, somebody will have it. This is a matter of atmospheric conditions. And those who renounce it are ruled by people who don't renounce it. If you look at the very successful career of the right over the last 40 years in America, you see that at crucial moments when they were feeling disheartened, and there were some among them who wanted to break from conventional politics, and, for example, to found a third party, that from their point of view, wiser heads intervened and said, if you do that, you're guaranteeing irrelevance. At other crucial junctures on the left, and we saw this most recently in the year 2000, those who were inclined to bolt from the Democratic Party and the Council of Realism did so, and thereby guaranteed the triumph of the other side. The right was too disciplined to do that. And although, you know, even in the early 60s, they were inspired to do it. They overcame their inspiration. and even though, you know, smart people were telling them that because Barry Goldwater was so thoroughly defeated by Lyndon Johnson in 1964, that the Republican Party was finished. They stuck to it. They were fanatical. They were extremely hardworking. They had a long view, and in the end, they prevailed.
Surely, you think that people on the left are not quite so woefully disorganized. I mean, they are perhaps being outorganized by the right, but surely there is some awakening to these realities now on the current scene.
There is. And, I mean, I think there's an argument on the left. Do you walk that path toward, sort of self-righteous solitude, or do you learn and practice the arts of, here's a hideous word, compromise? Do you accept that politics is in part deal-making? Do you focus on what you and your allies might develop in common, or do you accentuate the differences? These debates are going on today, and I'm happy to be in touch with people who are very much involved in these debates. I've been going around talking about the book in a number of places, and I discover once again these are live debates.
Hmm. that will probably go on to the end of time, I should think.
They deserve to.
Todd Gitlin, the author of Letters to a Young Activist, part of the series The Art of Mentoring, published by Basic Books. Todd Gitlin.